This morning, the first case for oral argument is the State of South Dakota versus Daphne Wright. Ms. Wright is the appellant, and she is represented by Ms. Tracy Smith and Mr. Jeff Larson, attorneys from Sioux Falls. Ms. Smith, I understand you'll be presenting the argument this morning.
Yes, sir.
And the State of South Dakota is represented by Megan Dilges, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Ms. Smith, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. We raised 9 issues in this appeal. However, given the time allotted, I would like to focus the majority of my argument as to the issue related to Ms. Wright's statement. If there is time, I would like to also go into issues 2 and 3 with respect to Ms. Wright's linguistic competency. I'll rely on the briefs with regard to issues 4 through 9. However, if the court has any questions as to any of those issues, I would be happy to answer them. I would like to start off by briefly talking about the facts relevant to the statements made by Ms. Wright during her interrogation at the Law Enforcement Center on February 7, 2006. On February 7th, Ms. Wright was interrogated at the Law Enforcement Center in Sioux Falls for a total of 7 hours and 21 minutes. During that time, she made 2 separate oral requests for an attorney, 7 written requests, and pushed the panic button in the interrogation room. Ms. Wright was brought to the Law Enforcement Center by her roommate at the request of law enforcement. She was immediately escorted to an area which was not open to the public, where the doors were locked electronically. She was put in a small, windowless interrogation room and questioned about the disappearance of Ms. Vander Giesen.
Were any of these circumstances unusual procedures for the police department, or is this their norm?
This is their norm whenever a suspect is brought into the Law Enforcement Center for questioning.
Is it the same whether they're in custody, under arrest, or not, the procedures that were used here?
It's the same.
Was she ever given her Miranda rights?
No, Your Honor. When a lawyer did arrive at the Law Enforcement Center to assist Ms. Wright, she was not even told that the lawyer was there. The lawyer was not permitted to speak with Ms. Wright. From the moment that Ms. Wright entered the Law Enforcement Center until she was arrested on February 13, 2006, she was never again outside the presence of law enforcement. She was never free to leave. She was permitted to return to a hotel in Sioux Falls, but she was not permitted to go to her home. She was not permitted to have access to her car. Her prescriptions and winter coat were brought to her at the hotel. Other than the clothes on her back and what's brought to her, all of her personal effects in her home were unavailable to her.
When did she make the statements that you're concerned about during that time period? Was it early on in the interview?
The statements that Ms. Wright made that we were concerned was specifically after she made her first request for a lawyer, which was at 12:30 p.m. She was brought to the Law Enforcement Center around 10:41, I think it was, but I'm not specifically sure. The first time she requested a lawyer was at 12:30.
Is that when she said, do I need a lawyer? Is that the first request that you're talking about?
Yes, Your Honor.
That lawyer that was there to see her, had she retained this counsel?
No, Your Honor. She had written several notes to the law enforcement officer, Detective Olson, I believe it was. She was provided with a pad of paper after the second lawyer request at 12:54. On those pages, I believe it's from the motion hearing on September 13, 2006, Exhibits 1 through 8. In the record, there are several written requests for a lawyer. In there, she stated that she wanted Ms. Chesmore's friend, Deb Voigt, to be her lawyer. And Ms. Voigt said she could not be her lawyer, but she had made a call to the public defender's office asking that somebody come, that there was somebody requesting a lawyer.
When did she say I need to speak to a lawyer, and they quit questioning her?
That was the second time that she requested a lawyer.
What time was that?
That was at 12:54, 56 a.m. The detective stated to her, "I don't want to hear, I don't know. You do know. What happened to her?" The interpreter said, "Okay, I need to call an attorney then because..." And then the detective cuts off the interpreter, so we don't know what else Ms. Wright said. The detective at that point said, "Okay, that's fine," and he gets up and walks out and says, "Okay, you're free to leave if you want to talk to your lawyer." At the suppression hearing, the state argued that that was the only time that her request was clear and unequivocal, and it was at that point that they stopped questioning her. However, she remained at the law enforcement center until 6:10 p.m. Our argument is that the very first time that she requested a lawyer is when the questioning should have stopped.
I'm still unclear on what her answers or what she said during that period of time and how that was used at trial or how it was used at all. I mean, I understand even if we say she did request a lawyer and the questioning should have stopped, what did she say that was harmful at that point that was used against her? How was it used?
She was... Essentially, the state argued that she was dishonest, that her whereabouts, her statements as far as not having contact with Ms. Vanderdiesen via the computer or canceling the visit. The state argued throughout their case that her statements were the motive, opportunity, the means.
And did they play the tape?
Yes, Your Honor. The tape was played during
the
jury trial.
To follow up on Justice Martin's question, what specifically did she say between 12:30 and 12:54 that was incriminatory?
There wasn't specifically what one might call a confession or an admission. The statements were related to her whereabouts that day, related to emails. I don't specifically have a transcript in front of me of what was specific within that time frame.
Well, then let me ask it this way. What did she say between 12:30 and 12:54 that was used against your client in the trial?
Her statements as a whole were used against her to argue that she had a motive to hurt Ms. Vanderdiesen, that she had the opportunity based on her whereabouts, this meeting to plan the surprise Valentine's Day party for Sally Collins, and the means as far as this meeting being at the Pizza Hut restaurant located in Sioux Falls.
And did all that occur between 12:30 and 12:54, or had that already been elicited?
I would have to look at the transcript, which I don't have in front of me. Our argument is that all questioning should have stopped the first time she requested a lawyer at 12:30.
Prior to that, did the police officers just pick up inconsistencies in her statements that made them believe that she was hiding something and being evasive?
Yes, Your Honor. She kept essentially saying, "I don't know, I don't know, I don't know."
Do you have any cases that indicate that picking up inconsistencies can be incriminatory and therefore, involuntary admissions?
Specifically as far as case law, not in front of me necessarily. If I understand what you're asking, our argument is her statements should have been suppressed. They should have been kept out. Whether or not they rose to the level of what one might call a confession or an admission is irrelevant. They should have been kept out. They never should have come in. They were still relied on by the state in terms of saying that her explanations were inconsistent. They still were used by the state to show that she had the motive and opportunity and means.
Was the first request or statement about an attorney was, "Do I need an attorney?" Was the question by her, "Do I need an attorney?"
Her first request was, her first statement was, "I wish I could help. Do I need to call a lawyer?"
And what was the police officer's answer?
He said, like I said, I just want you to sit here and talk to me. I want to figure this out. You know, if you didn't do anything wrong, then you wouldn't need a lawyer. I want you to talk to me and tell me what happened. Her request for an attorney was clear and unequivocal. There was the Davis case that by the U.S. Supreme Court that said, should I call a lawyer, was not clear and unequivocal. However, in this particular case, given Detective Olson's response, you know if you didn't do anything wrong, then you wouldn't need a lawyer. I want you to stay here and talk to me. He knew exactly what she was asking for. You can tell by his response. It was clear that he knew what she was asking for. The other...
And is your interpretation of his answer, no, you have to get one on your own?
Yes, that's my interpretation, that she would need to get one on her own. She had already made requests for a TTY. The only way that she would have been able to call a lawyer on her own is had she been provided TTY, which at that point, whether it was available at the law enforcement center or not, I don't know, but she was told none was available.
So if we agree with you that it should have been suppressed, do we engage in harmless error analysis? You've got no confession here.
I don't believe it is harmless error. When you look at the state's theory of the case, when you look at the record, page 76 of Mr. Nelson's closing argument, he referred to her statements 27 times. He stated, the motive, opportunity, and means are based on the defendant's own words. On rebuttal, on page 140 of the closing argument, Mr. Nelson, in his final words to the jury, one of the things he said is he referred the jury back to the statements she had made, stating the tape speaks volumes. That is not harmless error. The other issue we had in regarding the statements was the fact that the interpreter's hands were not recorded. Although we could see hear the interpretation of the interpreter, we weren't able to fully see the interpreter's hands as far as what was being interpreted to Ms. Wright. We didn't have the benefit of being able to go back and compare whether or not her answers were truly inconsistent or not. There were times when the detective was cutting off the interpreter so that she couldn't finish what Ms. Wright had said. So we'll never truly know whether the first time she requested a lawyer, she said, do I need a lawyer? Because we don't specifically have the tapes to know what was being interpreted.
When I watched the tape, you actually can see your client very clearly. So you were able to determine what she was signing, correct?
Correct. Well, you can see her profile.
So, and then you would have been able to hear the interpreter as far as whether the interpreter was correctly interpreting what your client was saying.
But the issue is as to whether Ms. Wright understood, and we were not able to see what was being interpreted by the interpreter.
You know, we, as you all know, we review these issues of constitutional significance de novo ultimately, but we are guided by what the trial court finds as historical facts, who said what happened, that type of thing. And in your brief, I didn't see where you challenged any finding of fact, of historical fact, by the trial court on the custodial issue of suppression. Are you not challenging the trial court's findings of fact?
I don't think there was any disagreement as far as what the facts were. Our argument is we didn't have all the information that we needed, particularly since the interpreter's hands are not recorded.
So the remedy then is what? Suppress it?
Yes.
Okay.
The next area that we addressed with regard to the first issue was with regard to the voluntariness of Ms. Wright's statements. In the Tuttle case, the state must establish voluntariness by a preponderance of the evidence. And also, the court talks in that case about looking at the totality of the circumstances and the factors that the court takes into consideration include the person's capacity to resist pressure, for example, the repeated accusations that the officers made, the fact that the officer told her if she repeatedly requested a lawyer, essentially it was the same as being evidence against her, the fact that she had a third grade reading comprehension level, the fact that she was prelingually deaf and not made a TTY was not available to her, and the fact that Detective Olson was cutting off her statements, the interpreter's statements, and that she was not apprised of her Miranda warnings. The behavior of the officer and the fact that she had pushed the panic button and requested a lawyer on the pad of paper that was provided to her seven different times shows that she did not feel that she was free to leave.
When you say she pushed the panic button, was that during the interrogation or was that after?
That was after the officers had stopped questioning at 12:54. At that point, they were waiting for the search warrant. Our argument, however, is even though they weren't questioning, the fact that she was still there, wasn't able to have access to the lawyer that was waiting out in the hall, it goes to the issue of voluntariness because their actions belie the fact that they were giving her the you're free to leave mantra with the demonstrating that the door is unlocked. So that's why we think it's relevant as to her voluntariness.
Okay, I want to make sure I understand that. So you're not suggesting that this somehow shows whether or not her statement was actually voluntary. It's more a reflection on the motivations of the police.
I understand the motivations of the police are not what the court looks at. The court looks at the subjective view of a reasonable person.
Objective
view of a reasonable person. So I understand that is not relevant. However, the evidence in and of itself, when you look at the totality of the circumstances, is still relevant because it shows how a reasonable person in Ms. Wright's position might feel given the situation.
But I still have a difficulty understanding what the police might have done or said, say at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, how that can relate to the voluntariness of a statement that she had made earlier in the morning.
It goes to show how a reasonable person in Ms. Wright's position might feel. She was still in the building. She was still not given access to the lawyer who was in the hall. It is relevant, and it does go back to the whole realm of her being at the law enforcement center, even though they weren't specifically asking her any questions at that point. Again, it goes back to the fact that the officers knew what she was asking for. They knew that she had requested a lawyer. They were aware of the public defender being in the building but didn't provide the lawyer to her. Ms. Wright's attempt to invoke her right to counsel were successfully derailed by the more sophisticated law enforcement officers. As a prelingually deaf suspect, she deserved the same protections that any person accused of a crime would be entitled to. Therefore, we are respectfully requesting that her convictions be reversed and remanded for a new trial.
I have a question on the interpreters. There was some confusion on how many interpreters there were actually in the courtroom at the time of the trial. Can you clear that up?
Yes, Your Honor. There were five interpreters who were in the courtroom. However, they were only having one interpreter interpret at once. They were switching off every half hour or so, so that the interpreters didn't get tired or fatigued, given the complexity of the case.
Was there an interpreter then also at the defense table?
Yes, Your Honor. There was one interpreter at defense counsel. However, there was only one interpreter interpreting at one time. It would have been impossible to look at more than one interpreter at a time.
Can I ask a question about that, too? I know one of your issues is that you feel that the interpretive services were not adequate, and you had expert testimony about what you and your client needed. During the trial, were there complaints made to the court that your client was not able to understand what was going on, or complaints about something to show that the interpretive services at the time that were given at the time were not adequate during the trial?
I see that my time has run out,
ma'am. Right, okay, yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you. Your Honor, the experts testified that the accommodations that needed to be made to ensure that Ms. Wright was competent was the use of a certified deaf interpreter and consecutive interpretation. The court provided the level 5 interpreters and the real-time captioning, which is of no use to somebody who reads at the third grade level.
Yes, I understand that, but my question is, I understand the experts before trial gave this information, but I'm asking that during the trial, did you complain to the judge because your client was not able to get wasn't able to understand?
Our argument was we had no way of knowing. Just as Ms. Wright had no way of telling me what she was not getting because she didn't have the background, the language needed to comprehend what was going on, I didn't have the ability to look at the interpreter and know what my client wasn't receiving. So we did not have that ability.
There were no complaints during the trial that this isn't working, Judge, that my client isn't getting this. You felt that you had made your record ahead of trial with your experts, and that was the end of it.
The accommodations that needed to be made to ensure that she could assist in her defense were the consecutive interpretation and the CDI. There were no specific complaints as far as whether I could see she wasn't getting the proper information because I didn't have that background to know, and Ms. Wright did not have the background to tell me.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I'll probably go over. Set the clock at 22 minutes. We'll give you an additional 2 minutes to equalize it if you wish to use it. You may proceed, Ms. Dilges.
May it please the court, counsel, Megan Dilges on behalf of the South Dakota Attorney General's Office. If the court would allow, I'd just like to give a little bit of factual background that Ms. Smith did not give to explain how we got to the interview that occurred with the defendant on February 7th. This case arose out of the jealousy that the defendant had towards the victim in this case. The defendant was introduced to the victim sometime in November of 2005 by Sally Collins. Collins was intimate partner of the defendant, and she was friends with the victim. This friendship caused a lot of concern to the defendant. She was extremely jealous of this friendship. Jealousy that escalated to the point in January 22nd, 2006, the defendant began sending the victim threatening emails under a fictitious name, advising the victim to stay away from the victim and or to stay away from Collins and to stay away from the deaf apartments.
So does this mean that she was a suspect when they brought her in for questioning?
No, Justice Meyer Henry, she was not. She was not a suspect
Sounds
at all.
As if you're saying they've already zeroed in on her prior to bringing her in to testify.
No, the defendant was
interrogator.
The defendant was brought to the law enforcement center requested to come to the law enforcement center on February 7th. How the request came about was after the victim went missing, her parents filed a missing persons report. During the course of that investigation, the victim's sister handed over to law enforcement these threatening emails that had been sent to her sister by the fictitious person, Wendy Smith, who they later learned was the defendant. The victim's sister gave these emails to law enforcement. During the course of their investigation, they did subpoenas to Midcontinent, to Quest, and to Yahoo to figure out where this internet account was coming from. The IP address associated with those emails led them to Jackie Chesmore and her home on South Phillips Avenue. The law enforcement contacted Ms. Chesmore about the missing woman, asked if she'd come to the law enforcement center for an interview. Ms. Chesmore said she did not know the missing woman, but she would come down. And then she said, "Would you like me to bring my deaf roommate, who may know her, down as well?" At that point, law enforcement didn't really know anything about the defendant. They said, yes, if she's willing to come down, have her come down. So Chesmore asked the defendant, come down to the law enforcement center.
During the interview, though, the officer indicates, we know a lot of this stuff. I mean, he uses that as a questioning technique, that we know all this, so you better tell us the truth.
They were aware of the emails, yes. They were aware of the emails because they'd been given them by the victim's sister after the missing persons report had been filed. They had figured out where the email address, the IP address, came from. That IP address was registered to Jackie Chesmore, the defendant's roommate. It was not registered to the defendant.
And they also appeared to have known at that time about this meeting at the Pizza Hut.
No, they did not know about the meeting at the Pizza Hut. At that time, based upon their interviews with Jackie Chesmore, with Sally Collins, with other members of the deaf community, they had known that there was some tension between the victim and the defendant, that they'd had an altercation or an argument 5 days before her disappearance on January 27th. They had known that there was that argument, but they had also learned from Sally Collins that apparently the defendant and the victim had smoothed things over the next day. So they did not know anything about the Pizza Hut meeting on February 1st until they began talking with the defendant during the course of her interview.
That goes more to whether it was a custodial and whether they needed to give her the Miranda rights. But on the flip side of that, it doesn't really matter whether or not it was custodial. If she truly asked for a lawyer, under Edwards, they had to stop.
Correct, Your Honor. And the state agrees with that. However, you mentioned that you've watched the video, and I encourage the other members of the court, if you haven't, to watch the video as well, because you will see, if you watch that video, that it's a free-flowing manner of communication. It's not a seven-hour interrogation that the defendant paints in her brief with these repeated requests for a lawyer that were ignored. When I read the defendant's brief, I was somewhat alarmed as well, until I went and watched the video. The interview that occurred was 2 hours in length. It began at 10:53 a.m. and it concluded at 12:54 p.m. when she unequivocally invoked her right to counsel. The statement at 12:30 was, do I need a lawyer? And Detective Olson responded that, I just want you to talk to me and tell me what happened.
Did he have an obligation under Davis or any other cases at that point to clarify whether she was asking for an attorney or not?
Detective Olson testified at the suppression hearing that he felt that her statement, "Do I need to call a lawyer," was asking him for legal advice, which he was not in a position to give her.
I understand what he might have thought, but of course we look at it from an objective perspective. Is that, from an objective perspective, would that have been an equivocal kind of request that he needed to clarify?
I don't believe it is. I don't believe that saying, "Do I need to call a lawyer," is the same as saying, "All right, I want a lawyer." It's the same type of statement that the court examined previously on, "Should I call a lawyer? Do I need to call a lawyer? Should I call a lawyer?" Those are both asking for legal advice from law enforcement, and the court held that "Should I call a lawyer" is not enough, is not an unequivocal invocation. However,
but that was after the Miranda rights were given. We've got a case here where there were no Miranda rights given.
That is correct. Miranda was never given.
So under the Davis, a defendant had already waived the right to an attorney. This particular case, she's never been ever told she had a right to an attorney or any of the other Miranda rights.
She was not. And I don't recall who asked the question, but there were some questions by several members of what happened between 12:30 and 12:54 that is at issue that that was incriminating towards her. And if you review the videotape, during those 24 minutes that occurred from the "do I need a lawyer" to "I want a lawyer" statement, there's a 10-minute break in there. So we're actually only talking about 14 minutes of conversation. There is no new statements that the defendant makes during those 14 minutes that had not already been talked about between her and the detective. They already discussed the emails and whether or not she had sent them. They had already discussed the meeting at Pizza Hut, that there was no meeting, that she had canceled the meeting, that she'd gone to the meeting but not talked to the defendant or to the victim, to the finally that she had met the victim at the Pizza Hut for 5 minutes and then she had left. All that has already occurred. The conversation has already occurred before 12:30. The only new, if you can call it new, piece of information that came out in that 14 minutes was she offered to have the vehicle searched. She just said, well, fine, she's never been in the vehicle. If you want to search it, you can. That's the only new thing that came out in that 14 minutes.
However, it sounds as if, I haven't read the total transcript, but it sounds as if that videotape played a very important role in the arguments of counsel at trial or during trial to show her demeanor and her inconsistent answers to some of those questions.
The videotape was played during trial. Yes, it was. And the videotape shows that the defendant came down to the law enforcement center. She was brought into the room. There were some questions by one of the justices about the room itself. This is a room that is used for anyone that comes down, whether you're a suspect, whether you're a witness, whether you're the victim. You're brought to one of these rooms. They're all the same. They're all set up the same. I believe Detective Olson, one of the other law enforcement officers, testified that all the rooms are the same. The camera is in the same position in all the rooms. It's a stationary camera. It can't really be moved. This was nothing out of the ordinary. It was done that same day to Jackie Chesmore. She was put in the same type of room. Sally Collins was put in the same type of room. The victim's parents, when they were down there, I believe, were put in the same type of room. So this is not out of the ordinary. This wasn't done because she was a suspect. The videotape was played to the jury to show that she was advised that she wasn't under arrest, that she wasn't going to be charged with a crime, and it was played to the jury to show the free-flowing manner of communication between the detective and the defendant through the use of the interpreter that was brought in. So, I mean, the videotape clearly shows the defendant was voluntary in her statements. She corrected the detective when he made incorrect statements or had incorrect assumptions about some of the things that were going on. It clearly shows that she was not in custody. Miranda was not required to be given to her and that her statements were voluntary. In addition to that argument, the state also would contend that she was not denied her Fifth Amendment right to counsel, that once she unequivocally invoked her right at 12:54, all questioning of her ceased. The remaining time that she spent at the law enforcement center that day was while the law enforcement, they felt, based upon their investigation so far, from the evidence that they had obtained by interviewing all kinds of people, not just the defendant, that they had sufficient probable cause to get a search warrant to search her person. She was detained at the law enforcement center. She was not under arrest, but she was advised that they were in the process of getting a search warrant for her person. She was not questioned at all the remainder of the time that she was at the law enforcement center. There are no statements the defendant gave after 12:54 p.m. that were used by law enforcement during the course of the trial. The only communication that they had with her was when they brought the interpreter to explain the search warrant to her, that this was what they were doing, and then they brought her water, and I believe she requested potato chips or a candy bar, I don't recall, but they brought her water, they brought her food, they took her to the bathroom when she requested it, they took her to her smoke on a couple of smoke breaks when she requested it, but no further questioning of her occurred after that 12:54 statement invoking her right to counsel. So based upon the evidence that's before this court, and it was before the trial court, she was clearly not in custody for purposes of Miranda. Her statements were voluntary, and she was not denied her Fifth Amendment right to counsel. The second issue that the defendant raises in her brief that the court touched on just briefly at the conclusion of Ms. Smith's argument was the interpretation and the request for a certified deaf interpreter. There were some questions about the number of interpreters that were provided and what the trial court did. The trial court, when examining this issue, the trial court held two hearings on this issue and took evidence on two different occasions to determine what would be the best way to accommodate the defendant in this case based upon her disability. SDCL 19-3-10 requires a qualified interpreter be assigned. What did the trial court do here? The trial court assigned five level five interpreters to this case. Three were utilized by the court, and two were utilized by the defendant. They sat at a defendant's table with her. The trial court also utilized real-time captioning, where everything that was said in court was projected up onto a large computer screen so that it was word-for-word what was going on.
So what was the harm in not giving her what she asked for?
Well, the trial court did, in a way, give her what she asked for because she requested a certified deaf interpreter, and one of the reasons that she requested one was to explain the complex legal issues that were going on in this case. The trial court did give the defendant a CDI prior to the proceedings to explain the complex legal issues to her. So the trial court did give her a CDI prior to the trial proceedings. There was just not a CDI that was at counsel's table with her during the course of the
and
trial.
That's a consecutive. Is that what CDI?
A CDI is a certified deaf interpreter.
Okay, but what about the consecutive issue that they had?
She also requested that all of the trial be done consecutive, meaning that a lawyer or a witness would talk, there would be a pause, the interpreter would translate what was said. When she was done, then the witness or the judge or whoever the question was posed to would answer, there would be a pause, they would go back. In examining this issue, the trial court looked at state law, looked at federal law, looked at the ADA, Americans with Disability Act, and held that the interpretation will be done simultaneously as the law does not require consecutive interpretation, and based upon the other modes of assistance that he had done, the use of the technology, the fact that the defendant was fluent in American Sign Language, both of her experts testified that she was fluent in that. They also testified that she could understand everyday conversations about people, about places, about dates, times. She could give a narrative. She could talk about past events. And the trial court felt that based upon her understanding of and her ability to communicate that way with the five interpreters, with the real time, and with the assistance of the CDI to explain the complex legal issues that honestly are complex to, you know, everyone, including lawyers at times, that he had assured that she was able to meaningfully participate in her defense.
Well, that was his determination ahead. That was his determination before the trial. Did he do anything, did the trial judge do anything during the trial to validate that these services were sufficient?
Yes, Justice Konenkamp. The trial court, at the defendant's request, the entire trial was videotaped, specifically the hands of the interpreter. And each morning, each evening at the conclusion of the trial, both parties were given copies of those DVDs of the trial. The following morning, every morning, Judge Zell inquired of the parties, did you get your DVDs? Do you have any problems? Are there any issues? Are we doing okay here? And to answer your question that you posed to Ms. Smith, not once did Ms. Smith, Ms. Larson, the defendant ever say to the trial court, what we're doing here isn't working, Judge. We really need that CDI. We really need the consecutive interpretation, not one time.
How do you prove a negative? How do you prove that someone is not understanding? That's the issue here, isn't it? I mean, we don't know if somebody is just sitting there blank or even nodding, whether they're understanding or not.
The evidence from the trial clearly shows that she was understanding. She understood what was going on in the course of the proceeding. The trial court offered, if at any time you're having problems, if at any time you don't get anything, let me know. We'll take a break. We'll do it as long. We'll take the break as long as you need. My recollection from reading the many transcripts in this case that there was one break that was taken at the request of the defendant during the jury selection. She wasn't quite understanding why our juror wasn't being struck for cause. I believe that's the only time they ever let the court know that they were having a problem. So it clearly shows that she knew she could ask for a break if she needed one, if she wasn't getting it. And during the entire course of the trial, every morning Judge Zell inquired, are we doing okay here? And not once did the defense say, this situation that you've set forth, Judge, is not working. We renew our motion. We need that CDI, or we need the consecutive interpretation.
Were any of the proceedings done with a consecutive interpretation?
No. It was all done simultaneously.
Even the preliminary hearings and things like that?
Correct. I don't believe there was any simultaneous interpretation.
If we're done with that point, I'd like to know, what evidence did the state produce that would support a kidnapping charge?
When looking at the sufficiency of the evidence argument as it relates to the kidnapping, the kidnapping statute that was in place at the time that the defendant was charged was that any person who shall seize, confine, inveigle, decoy, abduct, carry away any person, or hold or detain such person to inflict bodily injury on or to terrorize the victim of another. And in this case, they were charging it as a Class A felony with the gross permanent injury. So the defendant cites the wrong statute in her brief. The evidence that the state presented as it related to the kidnapping charge was the time frame that led up to the event on February 1st at Pizza Hut. There were the threatening emails. There was the on January 22nd. 5 days later, there was the argument and altercation at the Collins' apartment. And 5 days later, there was this alleged meeting at Pizza Hut. The defendant testified that she was going to meet the victim at Pizza Hut, basically under a ruse of planning a Valentine's Day surprise for Collins. The victim willingly went to Pizza Hut, but she thought she was going to plan a Valentine's Day surprise for Collins, when in fact the defendant had other motives.
Okay, so what evidence do you have from the time they got to the Pizza Hut to the time they got back to the house of any kidnapping? How do we know that it wasn't completely with her permission and consent?
The victim went there and met the defendant thinking they were going to plan a Valentine's Day surprise. She was inveigled or lured to the Pizza Hut and lured away with the defendant thinking they were going to do this. It's clear that the victim left the Pizza Hut with the defendant because her vehicle was found there by law enforcement 3 days later. The manager of Pizza Hut testified that her vehicle was there on the 1st, it was there again on the 2nd, and then they called the police on the 3rd.
Is that evidence of kidnapping?
It's circumstantial evidence of kidnapping. I mean, she went there thinking they were going to plan a Valentine's Day surprise, when in fact the defendant got her away and got her alone so that she could kill her.
Well, maybe they were going to the house to plan the celebration or the party.
But if she was, if the victim was going there thinking that they were going to do the party, when in fact the defendant had ulterior motives, the defendant lured her out of the public to her home, where she struck her on the head at least twice. She cinched a clear plastic. Thank you. She cinched a clear plastic bag over her head so tightly that it flattened her nose and cut off all air supply. She lured her away from that Pizza Hut.
That's what supports the murder charge.
Yeah, but she lured her away from the Pizza Hut so that she could get her alone, so that she could kill her. The victim may have went voluntarily thinking they were going to plan the Valentine's Day surprise, but if she was lured into going under the false pretense, that's circumstantial evidence of a kidnapping. It's similar to the Running Bird case, where the defendant in that case had lured the victim, who he eventually raped, away from the other campers under the, I moved your stuff over here, I believe it was, so it didn't, because of the water or the storm or something. He lured her away from the other group of people so that he could rape her. The same circumstances here. The defendant lured the victim away from the public, from that Pizza Hut, so that she could kill her. Does that answer your question?
It's going to have to do it.
Okay. Thank you. I would, the same as Ms. Smith, the state would rely on the remaining issues that were presented in this case, on the evidence that we presented in our brief and in the supplemental brief that the state filed, the Texas versus Linton case as related to the CDI that the defendant cited in her brief has since been reversed and found to be appropriate accommodations that were held to her. So the state would rely on the brief for the remaining issues, unless there are any other questions.
What about the Nebraska case that defense brings up in their supplemental brief.
You
haven't had a chance to respond to that by briefing.
I have not. I left town on Monday to hopefully avoid the storm so that I could get here. I did not have a chance to read the brief. Ms. Smith did give me the cite. I have reviewed the case, but I have not read her brief to see what she has to say about it.
What's your response to the Nebraska case?
I don't believe that it changes any of the state's position in this case as it relates to whether or not she was in custody for purposes of Miranda, as explained in the brief. And beyond that, I don't feel comfortable answering because I'm not sure how the defendant explained why that case supports her position.
Your time has expired, and you do bring up a good point. The court got the brief of the defendants yesterday. We'll give the state 7 days to respond and then 5 days for a rebuttal from the prosecution on the Nebraska case. Apparently that's the only issue that's still out there.
Okay. Has any brief been filed as it relates to the state's supplemental brief that we would respond to?
Well, they responded, if I recollect correctly, to the Texas reversal. So we'll throw that in the mix, too. And then, of course, the defendants may respond with the reply.
Okay. Thank you.
Does everybody understand? Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Smith, you have 10 minutes.
Ms. Smith, before you start your argument, so I don't interrupt you, you know, in the Litton 2 case, the concurrence describes what they call death relay, and they say that's the same as a CDI. I'm sure you've read that. Is that equivalent to what was going on in our case?
Yes, Your Honor.
They talked about having a witness testifying to a person with a hearing disability who is an interpreter testifying or then interpreting to a non-hearing interpreter who then interprets to the defendant and back and forth. Is that what you were asking for in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. Essentially what a CDI is, which in some of the case law you'll see referred to as a relay interpreter, is a deaf person who is educated, who serves as a cultural broker, if you will. They use mime, they use gestures. They essentially expand on meanings for complex words in which there is no sign. One example that I believe it was Professor Levine gave during one of the motion hearings was accident reconstructionist. There is no sign for accident reconstructionist. So rather than fingerspell A, C, C, it's actually a person who expands on it, say an accident to C, and then relays it out broadly so that the deaf person, when they don't have the background, can see it in their head.
I understand that, but that the way it was described in Litton 2 would suggest that there were two interpreters in that chain. And is that what you were requesting?
Yes, Your Honor. The interpreter listens to the witness, and then the deaf relay interpreter interprets to the client, expands on it. It's very interesting to watch. They're more pronounced in their facial gestures with the client.
So there's really two interpreters in the chain between the witness and the defendant.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Starting off with what the state first spoke about was the situation where they argue that Ms. Wright was not a suspect, that they were basically looking at anybody in the deaf community and bringing anybody in, because at that point it was still just a disappearance. I would respectfully disagree with that assertion. At the point on February 7th when Ms. Wright was brought to the law enforcement center, the state had already checked into her Quest records for her home, had already been in touch with Mid-Continent Cable, Yahoo. They were able to get through to Jackie's home based on her ISP address, which was her internet connection. They had already found her, Ms. Vandergiesen's vehicle at the Pizza Hut by that point. And the interviews of Ms. Chesmore, her roommate, and Ms. Collins, her girlfriend, were focused on, if you look at the tapes, they're in evidence, what did Ms. Wright bring home? Did you notice anything? Was there any disruption between Ms. Vandergies? And their interviews were not a disappearance of a deaf woman in the community. It is, what do you know about Ms. Wright? Second, the state spoke about...
You don't disagree, though, that you came voluntarily to the interview room, or to the police station in the interview room.
She came to the law enforcement center with her roommate, Jackie Chesmore. However, in the supplemental brief, you spoke about the Rogers case, where that woman came to the law enforcement center with her husband. And the court essentially said, coming to the law enforcement voluntarily doesn't mean there isn't that sea change at some point where it can become custodial. And the fact that a person is voluntarily in the law enforcement center when they're surrounded by police officers in the put in a room doesn't necessarily mean they might feel free to leave, especially when you look at the law enforcement center and the fact that she was not in a public area. She was behind closed doors in an area where even the public defender wasn't able to go back unless brought back. So a reasonable person put in that situation might not feel that they were free to leave.
Did Ms. Chesmore know anything about the events that happened theoretically in around the time of the meeting at the Pizza Hut and the murder?
Her, if I recall correctly, her interview, if you will, was focused on, did you see Ms. Vandergies in your home? She spoke about seeing Ms. Wright carrying out bags of garbage, some bricks out of the basement. That's the type of questioning that she received at the law enforcement center.
Did she tie any of it into a crime having been committed?
Her statements to law enforcement officer implicating Ms. Wright as far as removing suspicious items from the home. She was a witness in the trial based on her observations for that 2 or 3 day period. The state
also... question there. And did the officers get that from Ms. Chesmore as soon as they brought her in on this voluntary visit?
Yes. And that was the point where she was able to call a lawyer for herself, questioning regarding the things she saw Ms. Wright taking out of the basement, her statements about how it was odd that certain things in the back of the vehicle had been moved, and she had noticed Ms. Wright cleaning out the car.
And what time of the morning would that have been produced to the officers by Ms. Chesmore?
I don't have that information in front of me at this point.
Did they interview Ms. Chesmore in the afternoon?
No, it was at the same time that she went in with Ms. Wright. As far as Ms. Dill just spoke about that there was no questioning of Ms. Wright after the second request for a lawyer at 12:54 a.m., the reason that we still feel that it was relevant, even though there was no questions after 12:54, is the fact that with the 7 letters asking for a lawyer, not being permitted to speak with the lawyer out in the hallway, all of that information is still important because it belies the officer's "you're free to leave" mantra. Going to the issues related to the reasonable accommodations that were requested by defense counsel, the state spoke about Ms. Wright's ability to tell a story, her ability to speak in a narrative. All of that is very different from the complex legal issues and the factual scenarios in a murder case. The accommodations with the real-time captioning, given that she read at a third-grade level, was not sufficient, given that she was prolingually deaf. The experts testified that she needed the assistance of the relay interpreter. The state also spoke about 28 U.S.C. 1827, which is the statute in federal court.
2 minutes, counsel.
is the statute in federal court where it speaks about simultaneous interpreting for parties within the proceeding, but the statute goes on within the federal system that it's consecutive for witnesses. Finally, as far as the presence of the videographer who recorded the tapes, the evidence of the hands and the interpreter being recorded were preserved for future review. As far as not making any specific objections that were included as part of the record, just the hands of the witnesses were recorded. There wasn't a transcript that was also available at the end of the day. It wouldn't have been a situation where after being in trial for 8 hours of the day that we could go home and watch 8 hours of hands. We didn't have the ability to know what she wasn't getting.
You've now had several months since the trial. You've got the transcript. You've got the DVDs. You've got your client. And you haven't identified in your brief one instance of where there was a misunderstanding.
Because it's not in the record.
Well,
the simultaneous objections are not contained in the record as they were occurring.
But I guess maybe I don't understand. What I'm asking, I guess, is since you have the DVDs, you have the hands, and now you know what's happened after the fact, why can't you look back with your client, with the interpreter, and tell us in your brief, oh, I didn't understand this, or I didn't understand that, because you haven't done that. So I'm having trouble understanding what really was misunderstood in this trial.
Objections need to be made simultaneously as they're occurring to make our record. The hands, the videotapes, preserved the interpretation for future review. In the event a lawyer wants to look at them in habeas, they're preserved. They're there. But the accommodations we needed to make sure Ms. Wright understood are not on that videotape or of the hand.
Let me ask you a question, too, on that same subject. You had an expert who testified explaining to the trial court what was going to be necessary for this client to understand what was going on. Did the state have a counter-expert that gave a different opinion from what your expert gave?
No, Your Honor.
So what expertise did the trial court rely on then to make its decision about what was adequate interpretive services?
I don't know what authority the court relied on in deeming the real time and the five level five interpreter sufficient.
Your time has expired. Thank you, Ms. Smith.
Thank you.
The court would like to thank our interpreter who provided the services for us today. Thank you very much. And the court will be in recess for 10 minutes.